this hot, this the spot, there it is, pod.com. We're interviewing the best comedians, so tune in quick and get your ears receiving them. We talking about life and life to stream right to you, from the microphone right to your home, dude. Side note, this might get embarrassing, but no, don't sweat, yo, cause there it is.
Welcome to the There It Is podcast, the comedy podcast for creators of any variety. I'm your host, Jason Farr. Let's do this. Thanks so much for coming back, babies. So glad to have you back. And that was a long hiatus. Long and not self-imposed. Very forced hiatus, but good to be back. Listen, hard drive failed. What can you do? What can you do about computer issues? Took forever for it to get fixed and get back to me, but it's back, and now I'm back. We're back here together. It's great. Let's catch up a little bit. Justina and I started doing shows as part of the conservatory at the Magnet Theater, which is called Team Performance Workshop. Very, very cool. And it just hit me like a week ago, what's going on, you know, like that this is, this great thing that it is. I mean, I'm not trying to brag, but I am trying to appreciate what it is. And I love the Magnet. I think it's a great theater, a great curriculum. They're great people there. They're performers that I want to be like. And as far as the performer is concerned, and, you know, they're great people, so I would like to be like them off stage as well, but I also like me. But I've been so inspired by people of Magnet, and to get to be a part of this thing is kind of cool, and it took a couple of weeks for it to sink in, just how meaningful this is to me. So it's really nice to have that going on. And we also have our indie team, and we've had a couple shows last week, and we have a show tonight, and we're just super excited. And if you're in New York City and it's the 24th of July in 2018, as you listen to this, then you can come see our show tonight. It's at 10:30 at the Pit Underground. So do come out. You can follow us on Instagram too, at Boyf_improv. That'd be nice for you to do. We'd appreciate it. Other than that, nothing else to talk about. No, there's plenty to talk about. There's today's episode. We have guest Hunter Gardner, an old pal of mine from South Carolina. And we have a really great chat about creating work, especially his one-man show, which I got to see a couple of weeks ago. And this was done before the computer broke down. So we talk about the upcoming show at the time. That's how we were discussing it. But it's actually a previous show. But definitely go to Vital Joint sometime. Check out that venue. Very cool here in Brooklyn, New York. All right, let's get right to it. Here's my chat with Hunter Gardner. All right, man, we've known each other for years.
Yes.
But what I don't know is where you're from and how you got into comedy.
Sure.
I don't know how we've never had this conversation.
That's great. I did most of my growing up in North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of where I first started finding, like, some funny friends and stuff to goof off with.
Yeah.
My entryway into comedy was when I was really small, and I'd be in the car with my mom. So my parents split when I was, like, 6 or 7, mm-hmm. and when I was in the car with my dad, we'd always, like, he was an English professor, so he's mm-hmm. very, like, we would literally have these conversations that we called talking about thinking.
Oh, interesting.
So we would be like, oh, you know what's weird, this thing, or we would play this game called Cause and Effect, where it's like, okay, a man is running down the street with uh-huh. a Walmart bag full of money, like, what mm-hmm. happened? And so we'd come up with like 10 different things, right? So like, those are the kind of conversations I had with my dad. With my mom, it was more like, she's super great, but it was uh-huh. just more like, we're gonna put on a tape of something and kind of laugh together.
Oh, cool.
So that was, that'd be like Kermit the Frog stuff.
Uh-huh.
It's not easy being green.
Yeah.
And then it's too bad now, obviously, because of the history of what's happened, but Bill Cosby was like...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Bill Cosby himself is still, like, as old as it is, you could put it on now and it'll still get a lot of laughs. And that is hard.
Yeah.
Well, I don't mean put it on now in the sense that, because like anyone would be like, if you could like make it someone else's face and change, you could like CGI it.
Right.
Just the material and the pacing is so great.
So good.
And that, it was, it's always been so good. And it is hard to, like, have a conversation about
Yeah, that whole, like, separating the artist from the art and all that kind of stuff is obviously gets kind of messy. But, yeah, I mean, you could put on some of his stuff and play the first 30 seconds of it. I could probably finish the entire bit now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's kind of my earliest comedy stuff. And then I remember, like, in 7th grade theater class playing short-form games and that kind of thing. And then... I had tried stand-up in college, and I was in a short-form group my freshman year of college, and just things like that. Like, comedy was always kind of, like, playing in the background of my life. And but I didn't really break into it and start really, like, actively pursuing comedy until I moved to Charleston in 2012.
Okay.
I've been there for about 6 months, and I was taking... This is such a bizarre story. Every time I tell it, it just gets weirder. But I was taking graduate school classes at the Citadel, which you'll know because you're a South Carolina guy. I was taking, like, graduate-level classes there.
I didn't even know
there.
They had... Oh, you said graduate, not...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, it'd be very strange if I went there and I was like, I'm a cadet now. yeah, because it's military school. But they at the time, I really wanted to work in sports. Mm-hmm. And they had, I think, like a two-year graduate school program there.
Oh, okay, interesting.
And one of the classes was taught by this guy, Mike Veck, who is an infamous name in the Major League Baseball world, because he was the guy that was behind Disco Demolition Night.
Oh, that's where I've heard
the Chicago White Sox, and he also was the owner of the Charleston River Dogs. So, like, the River Dogs were also really famous for these, like, kooky promotions. Like, they gave a vasectomy away for Father's Day, and like,
oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, all just like these wacky.
And that's
promotions.
Who Bill Murray is a co-owner with. Okay.
Exactly. So Mike is teaching this public speaking class. The story's so weird. He's teaching this public speaking class, and. And he shows this clip from the Oprah Winfrey Show. And it's this guy who has, like, some kind of terminal illness.
Uh-huh.
And he's talking about how he wants to live out the few remaining months of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a Pursuit of Happiness type episode.
Okay.
And he says, I just started doing the things that I enjoyed when I was a kid. So this guy was, like, an outdoorsman. So he was like, I started going hiking and, like... build his kids a treehouse, or, you know, all these kind of, like, more outdoorsy things. And he's like, I've never been happier in my life, and I know I'm getting ready to die in 6 months. And so I just kind of started thinking about that, because I was at a kind of a breaking point in my life at that time, and I was like, man, I loved comedy when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I would think about me literally reciting back old Bill Cosby jokes in a tape player, you know?
Yeah.
When I was
Kermit the Frog.
In Kermit the Frog, you know? Just being 7 years old, going like, Kermit the Frog here, you know? And I was like, man, I love that stuff. So that's when I think I looked in, like, the local indie newspaper and saw that there was an open mic.
Oh, nice.
And then
it all took off from there, baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I knew a little bit about the North Carolina history. And we both had it, because we both talked about how we were in both Carolinas for so long. And I met you through stand-up, but you were doing stuff at Theater 99 as well as stand-up.
That's right. Yeah, so there was this really awesome improv practice group.
Okay.
And I couldn't take classes at 99 because I was taking these classes at the Citadel at night. They were night classes.
Oh,
so I call up 99 and they tell me about this improv practice group. So I start doing that, and that's when I meet like all those
great people.
All those awesome people, right? And I kind of catch the improv bug. And so for a couple years running, I didn't, like, miss a single open mic. I was doing a ton of stand up. And then also a lot of improv stuff.
Yeah.
And then I started getting into writing sketch and, like, storytelling and all this other stuff. And eventually, I was like, okay, I have to hone this down and figure out what are the couple of things that I like.
Yeah, so you're doing all that stuff now. And what became the sort of drive to keep going through with it, you know? I mean, like, Charleston's a pretty artsy town, so I imagine that has something to do with it. But what kept you going with it?
I had a couple of big ideas, like things I knew I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I just love doing improv. I got really into that as just a craft and even just like kind of a way of approaching things. I love the philosophy behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a couple of just these like projects would pop up. And so that's what probably kept me in Charleston for as long as I was there and what kept me going to open mics, kept me writing, kept me trying to self-produce stuff. One of those first big things was a two-man show that I wrote and then co-starred in, and also a solo show called Drinking with Jesus that I toured around last year. And then the last thing that I wanted to do that I ticked off before I left was like more of a ensemble sketch show, like hour-long, written by, directed by kind of thing. And so it was cool to be able to kind of tick off all those things and then make a move.
Yeah. And then you moved here. Yeah. And now that's at, what, 7, 8 months? What, no, it's a little longer than...
Yeah, it's like 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I'm not a numbers guy. I don't know.
But yeah, so you and I, again, like having a similar experience as the Both Carolinas thing, you decided to move here as well. And you're in that first year. How's that going?
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. I moved here because I wanted to kind of feel like just a student again and become a better writer and performer and be surrounded by other people who seem to really be kind of, you know, just going for it. I want to do it at a higher level and be inspired by those people. And all those things are happening.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I tell people that I wanted to level up.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you're doing when you're moving here. It's as great as Theater 99 and Alchemy, like our respective theaters, as great as they are, like, it's New York.
Right.
You know, like nothing compares to New York City. And so it's just a world of its own.
Yeah.
In every way, in all these different categories, too, of performance. Like, you can see any kind of show here, any night of the week. Probably a couple of them, you know, if you have the time, if you can make it across to the other shows. Like, it's amazing all the stuff that you can see here.
Yeah, and if you're really lucky, you'll run across something that feels, like, truly unique.
Mm-hmm.
And something that someone just... I was just talking about this with someone a couple nights ago, like, what are the things that inspire you? And I was thinking, like, it just someone... who you go and see whatever it is they're doing, whether it's like it's comedy, theater, music, and one, it's like they're really trying, like, and they've really put in the work, and they just have just doubled down so hard on whatever their idea is that it's just like it becomes undeniable. So that's another thing I really love about New York too, is like just the unique kind of stuff you can see, and also the things that it's just clear someone has a particular idea that they've put a lot of work in. That's the kind of stuff that has really inspired me here. But yeah, being kind of a new person, part of it is just starting your life over
again. Yeah.
You know, so anybody thinking about making that move, it's, there's always kind of like, you have a little bit of, self-confidence, and that you can look back on your track record and be like, okay, like I've done some fun stuff or whatever, but then also, you know, you move to a bigger town and it's like, all right, you gotta kind of start over again, you know?
You gotta start over again, but also square one here is harder than square one anywhere else. Because when I started in Greenville doing stand-up, you know, it was month 2 of doing stand-up that me and 4 of the guys started an open mic, you know, at Coffee Underground. And that's a popular place to do shows and for people to get shows out of there. And like so many people have gone, like Rory Scovel, Sean Patton, like all these really great people have been through there. And that's, you know, it's a great town to start in, but month 2, you're able to sort of be kind of a big dog.
Sure.
Because there was nobody else doing open mics, except for one guy, who was the guy who got us, like, it was the open mic we started on. And then, like, at some point, he stopped focusing on open mic and started focusing on, like, the book gigs. And so we were the only open mic in town.
Yeah.
And then when there was a second open mic, it was ours. You know? You know, so it's just, like, easy to do that there. And everyone's looking to you, but in New York, you're starting over, nobody knows you.
Right, yeah.
You go back home, everybody knows you.
Oh, right, yeah.
Everyone who's going to comedy knows you, you know, a month in, because there's so few people to know in comedy. But then here, it's like a million people. You know, like,
yeah.
It's hard to get yourself in front of the right people.
Yeah, and, like, how do you draw attention to anything? Mm-hmm. It's something that is... always kind of fascinated me. It's like, why would anyone go to anything, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, certainly in kind of like a smaller town or scene or whatever, it's a little easier to like kind of garner some mm-hmm. attention.
Yeah.
And
some cred.
Yeah, and some cred. But yeah, in a place like New York, I think that's another thing too, that at least for someone like me, it's almost kind of like, all right, like, let me show you, you know? So whatever that is, whether that's, I don't know, just like putting the work in and mm-hmm. being like, I just want to get so funny, you know, or.
And that's the thing, like, that's better. You know, like going to New York and cutting your teeth is better than it coming easy.
Mm.
Just because you get, it's so easy, and this happens here too, but it's so easy at an open mic to just get used to doing the bare minimum that gets you by. Whereas here, the bare minimum is not going to get you by. You know, it's not going to really get you what you want. Now, I have seen some people who seem to just be playing to the room. And right. It's like such a vacuum what that room is at times. Because it's like, yeah, but this is just you and your five buddies. And they're laughing, and you're just doing whatever to get those five people to laugh, but you're not working the material.
Yeah.
And, like, that happens really easily, and I think I started to fall into that back home. But here, like, you don't have time for that. That's not why you moved here.
Yeah.
You really want to, like, do the thing that you moved here for and do it right. And so you there's no safety net in that regard. Like, you just have to do it. And the only safety net is not doing it anymore. It's like quitting comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, open mics are interesting spaces. But yeah, you definitely get these people who are just like, oh, you just do like a bunch of open mics. And yeah, then you kind of play to the room. But I think, stuff like that is kind of like the attitude that you bring into the room. I've always mm-hmm. kind of had that, like, it's going to the gym kind of thing. It's like, and maybe I'm a freak, but I, like, enjoy, like, okay, I'm going to go do this joke. I'm going to go do this bit or whatever, and I'm going to record it, and, like, I'm going to take note of how it goes and, like, mm-hmm. what's my physicality during this thing, and then I'm going to go back, and I'm going to rewrite it, mm-hmm. and then I'm going to try it again. And,
yeah.
All those
that's the way to do it.
So, yeah.
That's what you have to do. There's a friend of mine who did stand up out in Los Angeles. I saw some, like, YouTube short that someone made of her going out and trying new jokes. And it's that same thing.
Oh, like, cool.
It didn't work in the first room. And this seems to be the reason why. And so we're about to go to another room and I'm going to rework it.
You know what? I found something interesting about that. Just talking about like the rewriting process, especially with something like a jokes or a story is it's like I had this bit for a while that I did several years ago and I kind of like dug back up and have started doing it again. But it was all about how like, oh, I don't like the whole bit's like, I don't like get to know you games because no one ever plays those games honestly. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
People always say something that like, we could at least guess about you.
You
know?
Yeah.
So, you know, and then the whole twist, there's like a twist at the end where it's like someone does play the game honestly and it's like not good news kind of thing. You know, it's like, but at least he played the game right.
Right.
You
know? Right.
And like the joke went well, but then, what I realized was it was just kind of like, you had jokes this before where mm-hmm. like it goes like 3.5 minutes and it's just kind of like a little bump, little mm-hmm. bump, big explosion, kind of, and then like you kind of like ride out little bump, big explosion, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I was like, one thing that like being in New York and doing open mics does is like it makes you want to get laughs Like,
yeah,
you don't necessarily have to change like your style or whatever, but mm-hmm. it's just like, man, you really got to bring it and mm-hmm. entertain people. And so when I went back and was looking at that joke again, I was like, you know what? But I do like getting to know people. Like, I do like kind of get to know you games. And so I just rewrote that whole joke where it's basically like, you know, I won't do the whole bit now, but it's like, I was never good at sports, but I was good at games. Especially like get to know you games, icebreakers, you know. And then I do like this act out where it's like I like dramatically overshare, you know. And like the joke does much better now. So mm-hmm. I think that's one.
Tweaking it like yeah. that. Towards the truth.
Yeah. Or something that you care. Like how
or care.
It's
yeah.
like what can I do that's like actually more truthful to what I really believe, and then also mm-hmm. how can I find a way to care more about
right.
this thing that I'm talking about.
Right, right. Yeah. That is a big thing to learn. And it's also really great because a few weeks ago we went to Comedy Cellar. It's really great that we can go to see those kind of club comics who really know how to work it. Really.
Yeah.
And they make it look so easy. They make it look like they're just going up there and shooting the breeze, a lot of them. But they're such like monsters on stage. Like they just, they're so on it and riding whatever that wave is that you have to, it feels like they're all riding the same wave, even though they all have different paces and styles and ways of riding the wave. It just seems like there's some sort of through line that I see through all of them of just how they perform on stage and how their pace works. And it's insane to be able to see that so regularly. And that's kind of one of the good things about moving to a bigger place like here or LA, because you can see them more. Like back in Greenville, we could see them every once in a while. But seeing one show that has a comic that great, and then their buddy who's okay, who's opening up for them, is not the same as seeing six comics back to back to back who are just pounding the audience with jokes. Like, it's unreal to see, and it's a good experience to have if you want to get better.
Yeah.
And that's a crucial thing, too, of just, like, moving somewhere. But then I guess there's also Atlanta.
You know, sure.
Atlanta has a lot of great comics.
I think it's really important too to kind of be fans of your peers.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's plenty of people that I see that do shows in Brooklyn, whether it's stand up or sketch or mm-hmm. characters or whatever it is, and just be able to point at someone and be like, oh, like they do that thing really well.
Oh, or, yeah.
Does that make sense? Or, mm-hmm. or just kind of being around people and being excited about the fact that like yeah. you're surrounded with people who are like really working on their craft, mm-hmm. like, and they're. And they,
it's infectious.
Yeah, it's yeah. infectious, and mm-hmm. it's, and even people that like so clearly, it's like, oh, like that's their deal. Like that is what they do, and to see them be really good at it is really really great.
Yeah, I mean that I know like we could see a lot back home. I mean, because there are a lot of talented people there, and so I think any like wherever you are, if you're performing, being excited about the people around you is a important thing.
Yeah.
You don't have to move to New York to be excited about it.
Yeah, no, I know that's not weird.
I just mean like in case someone was like, oh, I guess I gotta move to New York. It's like, no, you can love the people around you.
Yeah. That is non-location specific to just be a fan of your peers. You know.
What are the rooms that you like? Are there any specific ones? Top three?
To go see shows?
To perform in, like, open mics.
Yeah. I am a big fan of mics that are kind of, like, bring anything, like a mix mic.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Or there are a few like, comedy-specific mics that are like, yeah, it's comedy, but we want you to do something a little different. Mm-hmm. Or bring, like, a multimedia thing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite ones are, there's one in the Lower East Side under St. Mark's Theater.
Oh, okay. I think I've heard of this. I've not been there.
Tuesdays, it's like sign-ups at like 9:30. It costs $4, but you get 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who host it make it really fun. There's like a cool house band.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes late into the night. So like mm-hmm. if you get that like number 20 spot, you know, you're waiting 19 people doing 7 minutes before you. But you see really cool stuff there. You see music and clowning and stand-ups. And sometimes people do, like, a sketch. I really like that one, though, because it feels like... And there's usually an audience, so, like, it feels like a place where you can do different stuff. I really like the Ladies Who Ranch mic, which is at Vital Joint on Wednesdays.
Okay.
Ladies Who Ranch are, like, this really funny all-gal sketch group.
Oh, cool. Okay. I've not heard of them.
Yeah, their home base is... they're kind of, like, former Annoyance people.
Okay, yeah.
Who have now kind of found a home at Brooklyn Comedy Collective.
Okay.
I like that. There's one on Thursdays at Magic City called Magic Mike. That's pretty much straight stand-up, but, like, I think I've done weirder stuff there before, and... There's a couple of QED that kind of encourage
stuff. Right, yeah, QED is really great. Creek in a Cave has a lot of different stuff, and they're really great.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, Creek in a Cave is almost like you can just show up, and there's probably a mic.
Yeah, honestly, like, those are two great spaces. They're just a million years from me here.
Right.
They're so far. They're so far, and they're, like, great rooms, but they're so super far.
Yeah.
Halyard's is right down the street, and that's supposed to be a good mic. I've only seen comedy shows there, but I haven't gone to the mic. But shout out to Halyards because they're great. It's a great spot. So you mentioned the Brooklyn Comedy Collective and the, like, former Annoyance people. I know that you've gotten in with them. Tell us about working with them or, like, learning through them. Have you taken any classes with these people or done any practice groups or anything? Or what's been your experience?
Oh, sure. So those are just kind of the people that I've started to kind of hang around and become pals with. And so, yeah, so of course, you know, the Annoyance moved from Chicago to Brooklyn, and then it was up for, like, just like a year and a half or whatever it was and closed down. But then it was long enough for all those people to kind of, you know, want to put on shows together and things like that. And now it's since kind of relaunched. Some of the people behind that have now launched Brooklyn Comedy Collective. I don't feel, like, totally well equipped to, like, say, like, what their mission is or, like, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But it's basically, like, just some of the funniest people I've ever met. And
oh, cool.
A lot of it comes from kind of that more, like, Annoyance place or they have, like, some IO stuff that kind of gets muddled into their curriculum. But definitely more of kind of, like, just taking care of yourself on stage and then not being afraid to, like, throw a curveball into scenes and, like kind of, you know, starting grounded, but, like, there's a lot of, like, big character stuff or, like, weird stuff that's kind of, like, status quo there. But I would encourage anyone to go see any show at Brooklyn Comedy Collective. I think they put up really some of the most fun, cool stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's another thing here. I know everyone's talking about UCB or The Pit or Magnet, but there's Brooklyn Comedy Collective. There's, I don't know, is Risk still doing stuff? I don't know if they still are, but...
The Storytelling Show?
It might be that. There was some group that was also doing improv, though. And they may actually not be around anymore, but there is another place in the city doing stuff. And it's like, you know, people are talking about how good it is. And it's, and someone was just telling me about Improvolution.
Oh, God.
I just heard about that, and it's run by someone who has some sort of SNL background, but also was, like, it's like a character-based school.
That's cool.
Yeah, and the person who started it was teaching in Groundlings, taught Kristen Wiig, Will Ferrell, like some really great people. And so it's like there's so much here. Just because it's not the thing people are talking about doesn't mean it's not great, because it probably still is.
Yeah.
Like, that's the interesting thing here. It's just, like, this place is just seeping with so much talent.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go. Like, you can throw a pebble and hit somebody who could, like, sing their pants off or something. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And something else, too, I've noticed about whatever theater allegiance you have or, like, being involved with improv is this kind of becomes an indicator that, like, you are a person who is performing and doing stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that whole, like, I think that whole, like, folklore tale of, like, if you do well at, like, whatever, like, let's just pick on UCB. Like, if you do well at, like, UCB, then it's like...
You're going to get on SNL.
Baby, you're going to get in the biz. Like, it's like, no, it's like the people that I really admire that I see are doing stuff, whether it's out of UCB or elsewhere, it's like, yeah, they do UCB stuff, but then they also are, whatever, they're doing a... they're doing an indie sketch show, and mm-hmm. they also are an ensemble member at a theater.
Yeah.
Like, all these things just become indicators of, like, oh, you're a person who's doing stuff. Yeah, yeah, he's putting in work.
And that is really what matters, because, I mean, a lot of people will think, and a lot of people's parents are going to be like, well, why don't you just get on SNL, you know, if it's that easy. But one thing is interesting about that sort of questioning to me is that people don't do that with anything else. Like, if you say, oh, I'm starting a business, nobody says, well, when are you going to be a judge on Shark Tank?
Right.
You know, like, no one expects someone who wants to be a doctor to be as famous as Dr. Spock or somebody. Like, no one's doing that. Like, no one says to their doctor child,
yeah,
well, why don't you start a Mayo Clinic?
Right.
You know, like, nobody's ever going to do that with them.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
They will do that when it comes to entertainment stuff, where it's like, well, why don't you just, you know, like, so-and-so did this, so why don't you do it? And it's like, because they had a completely different circumstances. And the important thing is that we're doing it, because there are a million people who made a living, had a happy life doing stuff in obscurity.
Absolutely.
And that's totally,
like,
fine.
That's like my dream.
Right.
You know, in a, like, lot of ways. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes, like, I don't want to be... I'm not trying to shoot too low, but before Ant-Man, I used to say, and I think I said this to Greg Tavares, I used to say, like, oh, how great would it be to just have Paul Rudd's career where you're doing good work? Like, you get to do Wet Hot American Summer and Anchorman, and it's like, whatever, you know? Like, not the biggest star in the world. He's just doing work that you admire.
Right.
Because he's putting in the work. He's good. Like, I just want to be good.
Yeah.
I want to do work that I admire.
Yeah.
And I want it to make a living.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't have to be any more than that.
Yeah, that's what I used to tell people. I think I was talking to a friend of mine back in Charleston one time, and I was like, well, being like a comedy writer performer is my dream job, and a job is just something that pays you enough to live.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So we shall see.
Yeah.
But I do think about that. You know, fairly often where...
Yeah, me too.
It's like, yeah, you hope you can make the things that you want to make mm-hmm. at the end of the day. And, like...
Yeah, and on the level, maybe with the quality that I want to make it, you know, like...
Yeah.
You know, if I got a movie made and, you know, it wasn't something that was Oscar eligible or... You know, didn't even get on Netflix, but I somehow got this movie made.
Oh, gosh.
There are DVDs out there for it, you know?
Yeah.
If I admired it, and then people who saw it said, that's really, really good, then I would feel pretty satisfied, you know, as long as it didn't, like, put me in bankruptcy and, like, ruin the rest of my life. Like,
I mean, my personal nightmare is that I would do something that was, like,
huge.
That was, like, really, like, yeah. It's like, you make the next Anchorman, but then I become a person who hates comedy and also was, like, cutthroat to make my way to the top. It's like, I would hate the version of myself.
Oh, no. And there are people who want to play that game, and I don't want them around. And
right.
I don't want to get into that rat race, and I don't want to play that game.
No.
And it's so... Somebody was talking about this. I was listening to somebody recently, and they... And I'm sorry, I can't give them credit. It was a podcast or something, and I just listen to enough that I'm like, it's all mush.
I'm sure they're very upset.
they're not gonna
hear
this.
They're gonna find out, Jason.
But they were saying that the thing that's so weird about those sort of people is that they will act like they're a winner and everyone else is a loser and that they just created it themselves. When in truth, they got really lucky. Because there are other people who are working just as hard and maybe even did better work and it wasn't as successful.
Yeah.
You know, and it just because, like, you cannot compare your work and where you are in your life with where other people are in life and how they had something blow up. It's one thing if it's Thriller. Like, we all understand why Thriller was as big as it was, because it deserved to be.
Yeah.
But there's some things that just blow up, and it's like, that's really good. It's not necessarily better than anything else. It's just the thing that got in front of everybody.
Right.
Yeah. And just for whatever reason, we are all just ready for it right here, right now. Like, sure. If it had come out a month later, it wouldn't have had the same response from the audience. But yet, those people want to believe that it was all them that made it happen. And it's like, well, that's just not how it works.
Yeah. I don't know if ego does you much good.
No.
Yeah. Even from what I can tell from talking to people and just all the behind the music stories that you hear, it's mm-hmm. like, yeah, if those are kind of, listen, we all want to do well mm-hmm. and make cool stuff. But like, if that is like your sole channel of happiness, mm-hmm. then you're probably in for a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Because there's always the next thing or the person that's doing something.
Right. There's always going to be a new kid in town. Yeah. Never going to be the one. Like, you could be really, really great, and then somebody else comes and they're either better than you at the same thing or great at something else,
mm-hmm.
and people are just gonna like start paying attention to them, and you cannot handle being that arrogant. Like, it's gonna ruin you.
Dang, dude, I love how right we are.
Well, I mean, that was something I learned in college from a friend of mine talking about someone else who was in the music department and how arrogant he was. And I was like, but that guy's not that good. Like, right. He was like a really fast guitar player. He was like, he had that technique down really well. But otherwise, like, he wasn't impressive. And it wasn't enjoyable to listen to him because he was so focused on showing off with that one technique. And was like, okay, can the next person start soloing now? Because this isn't fun to listen to. And that's the thing, you know, like, he was super arrogant and was like, well, somebody else is going to come along and really humble that guy.
Yeah.
And it hopefully won't destroy him.
Right.
Hopefully it'll happen sooner and not, like, when he's, you know, he never got famous or anything. So hopefully he did get humbled in a way that isn't devastating to his livelihood. But that's when I learned that, was like, oh, don't be that person. The other person I wouldn't want to be in the shoes of is the person who has, they're not arrogant, but they have overnight success. They have like blow up in such a way that the industry just looks at you like a commodity and run you like a business. It's like, I'm a person though, you know, and that you can't, like, I've heard Vince Vaughn talk about, you know, he's had some string of movies that didn't do well. And he was saying, like, you know, I've been on sets where we're working this script from all these different angles and trying, you know, like, it because of studio notes and, you know, all these different cooks in the kitchen and all these different things, that it ends up wringing all of the humor out.
Oh,
you
know,
and it's just like not fun. It's not fun to do. But he got to be such a commodity that he just had to do those moves. You know, he wasn't getting the other offers. Like, he's had a very weird and interesting career, because, like, Swingers just blew him up in a specific way that he got in Jurassic Park 2. But then he, like, went away from trying to do studio stuff and did stuff like Clay Pigeons and Cool Dry Place and all these, like, indie art house films.
Yeah.
And then when it came around to, like, Dodgeball and Starsky and Hutch and, like, some of those comedies, when he blew up in comedy again, old school, he kind of had to fight to get cast in them because the industry didn't see him as a comedy guy, even though Swingers was the whole thing that made him well known anyway.
Right.
But they just saw him as like, yeah, he's in these art house movies. All of them, you know, like, that's what he became to them. And so then now he's become the comedy guy, but like that kind of comedy that's like manufactured by the studio and like corporate comedy made films, and he's trying, but like, it's still like the corporate element is still there, and it's gonna wring the humor out of those scenes.
Yeah.
And that's a weird place to be, you know.
It's gotta be a weird place to be, where like you become like essentially a product, right? Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. something I've been thinking about a little bit too. It's like, you know, just trying to be a professional funny person, at some point it's like you have to have something that kind of like sells or is sellable mm-hmm. or just like appeal, you know, mm-hmm. hopefully it's people like your stuff, but like at some point it's like you have to kind of sell yourself or sell your
yeah.
whatever it is. And
I don't know how people do it. I don't, because some people find that balance
yeah.
of like Beyonce is working the business side of things effortlessly and like and like such a badass.
Right.
And then also she's still doing Lemonade. She's still doing stuff like that that is resonating with people in a huge way. So how do you focus on the art and the business so well? Like, I think there's just like a handful of people who can. But when you don't have any say, you can't like take yourself out of the say of either side of it. You know, if you are only thinking about the business side of it, and someone else will figure out the art side of it. And if you just focus on the art side of it, then someone will focus on the business side of it for you and maybe make some decisions you don't want to make. You know, like, it's hard to do both, I imagine, but Seinfeld is doing it. You know, like, he...
sure.
You know, he knows the business and he knows what people want, but then he's also, like, doing legitimately good work. You know, right. like it's a good act.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and stand-up is that one where you really have to... You're talking directly to your customer, and they are talking directly to you through laughter, hopefully,
yeah.
and not actual words. But
yeah,
but like it is an exchange like that of like, what do you want? You want this? Here you go, and not doing it in a phony way.
Yeah, hopefully you land in a place where it's like whatever that kind of product-y version of yourself is pretty close to your actual self, mm-hmm. or at least like something that you believe
yeah
or like is your point of view
yeah
right
yeah
yeah that's but that's got to be a interesting like rung on the ladder, that kind of thing, where it's like if you're lucky enough to get that point, then how do you make it a blessing and not a curse?
Right We're talking about creating stuff, but in a broader sense, let's talk about the creating that you're doing. You have a show that you worked a few shows that you've worked on that you already mentioned, but you have a show that you're working on now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I have a new solo show that I'm developing, and I'm really excited about it. It's I've taken a bunch of the material actually back down to Charleston, and then I've since revamped it. I'm going to do a workshop of it in Brooklyn mm-hmm. at this place called Vital Joint, which is super great. I'd recommend nice. Any show there. But it's going to be Friday, July 6th.
Cool.
And the show is called How to Make Friends, Find Love, and Not Be Lonely, or at least try your best.
Nice.
And it's great. It's I'm really excited for it. It is a show that is not about me.
Okay. Okay. So, I thought it was now. The title sounds sad, so I guess I'm glad that it's not about you.
Right.
But how does that work? So many of these one-person shows, they are about the person, their own experience, something like that, even if they exaggerate it. How is it working on something that's not about you?
Yeah, so when I put up my last solo show, it was called Drinking with Jesus, and it was an autobiographical story, but mm-hmm. about a specific story in my life, and we told it all through character monologues. Mm-hmm. So it was really important to me and our pal Henry Riggs, who co-created yeah. and wrote it with me, that it not be that kind of I was born on a cold Tuesday in December, like, you know, this is my life and it's so important. So we just want to make it entertaining and fun, but still kind of give it some heart. But when mm-hmm. I was putting that show up and taking it around, and even when I was still writing it and stuff, knowing that it was a solo show, I started to become more of a student of solo shows. So I would go seek those out, whether I was watching it on YouTube or some guys mm-hmm. coming through town, or our pal Jason Gross put up a solo show at Theater 99 mm-hmm. in Charleston. And what I realized is that, you know, basically a one-man, one-woman show, that's all it is. It's just mm-hmm. like one man or one woman on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so one version of that is kind of a narrative, maybe something autobiographical, but it can also just be like a string along of bits.
Mm-hmm.
Or something that is more thematic. I think of a show, I'm going to forget the guy's name, but I'm sure he brought to Greenville the show, The Magic Negro and Other Blackness.
Yes. Had him on the podcast.
Did you? Oh, that's great.
He's great.
I'm sure.
Mark Kendall is
Mark, yeah. Yeah.
So great in every way possible.
Yeah. So that show's a great example.
Yeah.
So this show is, I wanted to, even though I love the Jesus show, I wanted to do a show that was less about me and more about we.
Mm-hmm.
And so the show kind of hinges on this idea of like, you are you, you mm-hmm. always have been. Why is it so hard to just be yourself?
Okay.
And then kind of, and then kind of just tackling those things of like making friends, finding love, fighting loneliness, all while kind of being you and the fact right. that you can't escape who you are.
That's very interesting.
And so my goal for the show is that people will walk away feeling a different way about themselves.
Yeah.
That really is kind of the engine for this show mm-hmm. as far as like what's really kind of motivating me and inspiring me to keep working really hard on it. And it's funny. It's a comedy and it's a mashup of there's no microphone, but essentially mm-hmm. stand up and like characters and little solo sketches,
mm-hmm.
storytelling stuff like you might hear on like The Moth or This American Life,
mm-hmm.
And then also like kind of like improvised audience interaction stuff. So the show like clips right along,
right?
And I really like it. I'm gonna put up this workshop production in Brooklyn, and the goal for that is just to get it up on its feet and get some feedback on it, and maybe get some people interested in kind of jumping on board on like the production side, because mm-hmm. kind of like you alluded to earlier, it's like when you're self-producing something or you're trying to put something up, it's like you have to do everything.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice to get a director or someone that like be interested in kind of producing it. Just help, like I've dipped my toe just enough into the theater world that mm-hmm. like I can kind of steal some ideas from there. And one thing that I do like about that world, the theater world, is like the development process.
Yeah.
I mean, you can develop something into the ground, but mm-hmm. I do like the idea of like, you know, or like
again, going back to the wringing the humor out of it even.
Yeah. Yeah.
That happens a lot when people start overthinking things.
Yes.
And, yeah.
So what I'm shooting for this is like instead of like putting a show up and being like, this is it, like world premiere. It's like, no. Like it's a workshop, like I'm developing this show.
Right.
Right. And
that's a good idea. You know, and that is I don't think a lot of people know, I don't like outside of the theater world, how common it is that something's just like getting on its feet and it's not a finished product. Like,
right.
You just hear about plays and you're like, yeah, okay, Neil Simon, you know. But,
right.
But
first, you know, draft, put it up.
Right. Yeah, people just don't know. But it is like they may do a public reading, and then after that the writer will tweak some things and get feedback from the audience, do a Q&A afterwards and everything, and then they'll have an audio, some theater do a small version of it.
Exactly.
And just see like, okay, does this even work going from this scene to that scene because of the changes that the crew has to make and the actors have to make? Like, small little choices like that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there's actually not enough time for them to change those outfits, so I gotta change this up a bit and move things around. Like, there's all this thought that has to go into it.
Absolutely. And so it's important to me to kind of make something good instead of something fast. And
right.
Even though it's not a show about me, there's still a lot of me that has gone into the mm-hmm. show, and that this is obviously, like, I'm writing it, I'm performing it, so it's, like, my sense of humor, it's, like, what I think is really funny right now, or these are subjects that I care about and want to talk about, and so if I'm putting my name on it and putting it out into the world, I want to make sure it's, you know, it's good.
Yeah.
But I think it's good now because it's my job to think that, but inevitably it'll change, mm-hmm. and I really, really, would love to have Vital Joint packed that night, because mm-hmm. Not because it's always nice to have people come to your show,
right?
But there, and this is something that I learned from a lesson learned from doing the Jesus show, mm-hmm. which is a show essentially about finding a balance in life between your virtues and your vices.
Oh, interesting.
And
that's very interesting. Yeah, because I never got a chance to see that.
Yeah, and that's what it's about. And then in in some ways kind of pointing to some things that are just, without poking fun at anybody, mm-hmm. but just some things that are funny mm-hmm. about church world, and then also like mm-hmm. party world, like college, you know, yeah. frat life and stuff, right? So my favorite part of that show was talking to people afterwards who are mm-hmm. like, I really enjoyed that because of this thing that happened to me, or mm-hmm. This thing really resonated with me. And so mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that this show had a ton of that in it. So the reason why I want people to come to the show is because it's nice for people to come to your show and all that kind of stuff. And you can't have a show without an audience. But like, I really, really, truly, deeply believe that this is a show for the people that come to the show. So that's what's getting me most excited about it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's, I've never done a show like that. I mean, I did a one-person improv show, but I've never written an hour. That was insane. It was a lot of fun, but I didn't go an hour. You know, it was just like, yeah. I don't know, 15
how could you?
Yeah, I know. You know, maybe TJ or Dave could do 1 hour alone, but, you know.
Yeah.
I did like 15 or 18 minutes or something like that. But I've never written a show that was just me that was an hour and it wasn't stand-up. Because there's a difference between an hour stand-up show, which I've done it once or twice or whatever, and a show like this, like a one-person show. It's the theatrics about it, but also just the structure.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up with around a lot of story and narrative in my life, so I think mm-hmm. that's kind of how my brain works, and mm-hmm. just being a big fan of, you know, again, I have one of these dads who was like, you're 13, we sit down and watch this movie now. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. And so that's just kind of got embedded in my brain. And so I like these things that are like narratives or thematic, things that come full circle. And I think conceptually a lot, often to a fault. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think that is one nice thing about putting a solo show together, is you can say this is a show about this, or these kind of three things. Like, this show is about making friends, finding love, and mm-hmm. fighting loneliness. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be the real? What does it mean to be who you really are? Mm-hmm. Right, and the fact that you can't get away from who you really are. Mm-hmm. That's what this show is about. And so it's like, cool. That can be an hour long show. You right. surely don't set out saying like, I'm gonna write an hour long show
right.
for the sake of being on stage for an hour. Right. But once and through like the writing and workshopping process, that's how I kinda landed on those themes. I kinda looked at like what those through lines were, and then and now I was like, oh cool, now I can just make the show more like this thing that it looks like it wants to become. And so yeah, I think solo shows are a great opportunity to talk thematically mm-hmm. about things, or to like really tell a complete narrative. Of course, we get that all the time through plays and movies and right. television and things like that. But what drove me to want to do another solo show was just looking at what I was already working on, mm-hmm. and then the fact that I think conceptually, I was like, well, instead of just trying to do 10 minutes of stand-up or like a couple of these like new characters, like why don't I try to package these things together.
Mm-hmm.
And I like where it's headed.
I'd love to do something like that. I feel like that's not an immediate future goal of mine. Like, you know, it's not something I think I could start trying to develop in the next, I don't know, 5 or 6 months. But that would be cool to do. And I think that's the perfect thing for us to go into the end of the episode with the creating something together sort of thing. I, and I'm sure someone listening, would, let's say we want to create a one-person show. What are the best next steps? Like, we've seen one-person shows, but we've never developed one before. So what's the good steps to take?
Sure. So the first thing, if someone wanted to start working on a solo show right now, the I'm just going to pretend like you're that person.
Yeah,
so,
let's say, yeah, I want to create a show. Yeah. What are the good next steps to take?
Then I would encourage you, first of all, to know that what I said earlier, right? It's mm-hmm. just one person on stage
right.
for 30 mm-hmm. minutes or an hour or whatever it is. Doesn't have to be necessarily a narrative or semi-autobiographical mm-hmm. or anything like that. Also, I would look at the things that, what are the, maybe if it is going to be something that is autobiographical, what are, what is like that one most unique story? Kind of like, people talk about movies this way, right? Like, movies are always like, this is like an insane moment in this person's life that they're probably never going to have again, right? So, like, what is that for you? For the Jesus show, I was doing free writes, and I was talking about my history with alcohol, and then I was like, yeah, I got really into partying after college, and I got really into church, and then I thought that God had called me to move to Charleston, South Carolina to save my childhood best friend, and I was like, that's an interesting thing. That can maybe be like the, so I would look at that stuff, and I would watch other solo shows to see what you like.
Yeah, that's the I was going to ask, like, how much homework does someone need to do?
Yeah. I would say to seek those things out, like if one's coming through town, or if you're lucky enough to live in a place like a New York or Atlanta or something like that, where there is a lot of stuff. I would encourage, and then kind of the last thing I would say is, like, remember that, and this might be hard for someone to hear, but remember that just because it's your show is not an interesting enough reason, or just because it's your story is not necessarily an interesting enough reason. This comes back to what I was talking about earlier about, like, why does anybody go to anything? It's like, people don't have to come, even if you're just putting up a stand-up show or something, but something like a solo show for sure. It's like, people don't have to come. People could go to the movies. The movies are probably better. So what's gonna make your show interesting, both to get people in the door, and then once they're in the door, what's gonna kind of have them be like, man, that was cool.
Yeah.
And some of that can go into how you present it. Some of that can be how you create some kind of, how you can surprise the audience. But I think one of those things too is to make a show that, yeah, it has to be bigger than just yourself.
And of course, like, people will say, yeah, but I was taking an improv class or a workshop that was called You Are Enough. And that's true, but they are speaking on, like, the difference between an improv scene when you're kind of stuck and don't have a character. You're kind of like, well, you can just draw from your life. That's enough.
Absolutely.
And you deserve to be on stage. That's enough to be on stage. You don't have, that's what they mean when they say that. But, of course, with a one-person show, there's oftentimes a narrative. There's something specific that's being explored. What is the thing that people can relate to? And that's when it's, what's something bigger than you?
Right.
And that doesn't mean that you aren't enough. It just means, what's something that everyone can really get into with this?
Yeah. And inevitably, a lot of you will end up in that show, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. And someone who was on this podcast before said, I can't remember the quote, the person who's quoting again, they're going to be so upset. But he was saying that the more specific you get, then the more relatable sometimes it can be.
Like, yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but that's something too. It's that when you are being like, well, Anthony Bourdain just passed away, and his writing that got people so excited and into him, why he was an overnight success in that regard is because he was so specific to the world he was living in, but it was more than just him, you know? And that's a perfect example of what we're talking about now. Like, if you're going to write something, go in that vein. Like, yes, you're being that specific. Yeah, you're talking about your background, but it's actually something bigger that you're exploring here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm. Like, you could put up, I was talking to someone recently that, like, they love fonts. Like, they're really into, like, typeface and things like that and history stuff. And he was talking about how he wanted to do a solo show. And I was like, I think that's great. That's so specific.
Yeah.
And, like, you're such a freak for loving that. And I love that you love it. So, like, whatever it is, like, just keep writing about how much you love fonts. And then maybe you'll find some kind of, like, universal theme or something like that. But, yeah, something really specific like that is great. Yeah. Please don't do one that's about your entire life. You know, pick, like, a specific moment in your life. And then, again, like, what are... Yeah, like, you can just pick a couple themes. You can just do, like, Jason Gross's show was great. Like, it had a little bit of a framework to it, but it's basically just him doing solo characters. So it's just almost like a character showcase. So, yeah, it's just you on stage, but how can you make that interesting?
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. There it is.
There it is, baby.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. For sure.
Cool to hang.
Now, that was a fun time. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Really great to have him on, and it was really cool to hear him talk about that show and how he put it together, and then go see the show shortly after that. It was actually like July 6th that show happened, and it was really cool to see. I haven't really seen many one-man shows or one-person shows, and that one was really nice. It was a good time. You can find out more about Hunter if you go to his website, huntergardner.com. You can also follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Hunagodna. You kind of have to say it like you're a five-year-old. Hunagodna. And that's how you spell it. Links in bio. It'll be easier that way. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at There It Is Pod. You can follow me on Twitter at Jason Farr Jokes. And you can follow me on Instagram at Jason Farr Picks. Well, folks, that's today's episode. Fun stuff planned for the future. Until next time, be good to each other.
The music for the theme song was created by Neil Brooks. The rap was written and performed by Nick Acevedo. The logo for There It Is was created by Jeff Prater. The There It Is podcast is produced by Jason Farr.